It was a 500-mile journey, and surprisingly quite uneventful. People who are rather more than 6 feet tall and nearly as broad across the shoulders often have uneventful journeys. People jump out at them from behind rocks, then say things like, "Oh, sorry, I thought you were someone else." He'd spent most of the journey reading, and now Ankh-Morpork was before him. It was a little disappointing. He'd expected high white towers rearing over the landscape, and flags. Ankh-Morpork didn't rear. Rather, it sort of skulked, clinging to the soil as if afraid someone might steal it. There were no flags. There was a guard on the gate. At least he was wearing chainmail, and the thing he was propped up against was a spear. He had to be a guard. Carrot saluted him and presented the letter. The man looked at it for some time. "Hmm?" he said eventually.
"I think I've got to see Lupin Squiggle Seki PP," said Carrot.
"What's the PP for?"
said the guard suspiciously.
"Could it be pretty promptly?" said Carrot, who'd wondered about this himself.
"Well, I don't know about any Seki," said the guard. "You want Captain Vimes of the Night Watch."
"And where is he based?" said Carrot politely.
"At this time of day I'd try the bunch of grapes in Easy Street," said the guard. He looked Carrot up and down. "Joining the watch, are you?"
"I hope to prove worthy, yes," said Carrot.
The guard gave him what could loosely be called an old-fashioned look. It was practically Neolithic.
"What was it you'd done?" he said.
"I'm sorry," said Carrot.
"You must have done something," said the guard.
"My father wrote a letter," said Carrot proudly. "I've been volunteered."
"Bloody hellfire," said the guard.
Now it was night again, and beyond the dread portal...
"Are the wheels of torment duly spun?" said the Supreme Grand Master.
The elucidated brethren shuffled around their circle.
"Brother Watchtower," said the Supreme Grand Master.
"Not my job to spin the wheels of torment," muttered Brother Watchtower. "It's Brother Plasterer's job spinning the wheels of torment."
"No, it bloody well isn't. It's my job to oil the axles of Universal Lemon," said Brother Plasterer hotly. "You always say it's my job."
The Supreme Grand Master sighed in the depths of his cowl as yet another row began. From this dross he was going to forge an age of rationality.
"Just shut up, will you?" he snapped. "We don't really need the wheels of torment tonight. Stop it, the pair of you. Now, brethren, you have all brought the items as instructed?"
There was a general murmuring.
"Place them in the circle of conjuration," said the Supreme Grand Master.
It was a sorry collection.
"Bring magical things," he'd said.
Only Brother Fingers had produced anything worthwhile. It looked like some sort of altar ornament. Best not to ask from where. The Supreme Grand Master stepped forward and prodded one of the other things with his toe.
"What," he said, "is this?"
"It's an amulet,"
muttered Brother Dunnikin.
"It's very powerful. Bought it off a man. Guaranteed protects you against crocodile bites."
"Are you sure you can spare it?" said the Supreme Grand Master.
There was a dutiful titter from the rest of the brethren.
"Less of that, brothers," said the Grand Master, spinning around. "Bring magical things, I said, not cheap jewellery and rubbish. Good grief, this city is lousy with magic."
He reached down.
"What are these things, for heaven's sake?"
"They're stones," said Brother Plasterer, uncertainly.
"I can see that. Why are they magical?"
Brother Plasterer began to tremble.
"They've got holes in them, Supreme Grand Master. Everyone knows that stones with holes in them are magical."
The Supreme Grand Master walked back to his place on the circle. He threw his arms up.
"Right, fine, okay," he said wearily. "If that's how we're going to do it, that's how we're going to do it. If we get a dragon 6 inches long, we'll all know the reason why. Won't we, Brother Plasterer? Brother Plasterer? Sorry,
I didn't hear what you said? Brother Plasterer?
I said, yes, Supreme Grandmaster, whispered Brother Plasterer.
Very well, so long as that's quite understood.
The Supreme Grandmaster turned and picked up the book.
And now, he said, if we are all quite ready.
Brother Watchtower meekly raised his hand.
Ready for what, Supreme Grandmaster?
He said.
For the summoning, of course. Good grief, I should have thought.
But you haven't told us what we're supposed to do, Supreme Grandmaster, whined Brother Watchtower. The Grandmaster hesitated. This was quite true, but he wasn't going to admit it.
Well, of course, he said. It's obvious. You have to focus your concentration. Think hard about dragons, he translated. All of you.
That's all, is it? Said Brother Doorkeeper.
Yes.
Don't we have to chant a mystic prune or something?
The Supreme Grandmaster stared at him. Brother Doorkeeper managed to look as defiant in the face of oppression as an anonymous shadow in a black cowl could look. He hadn't joined a secret society not to chant mystic runes. He'd been looking forward to it.
You can if you like, said the Supreme Grandmaster. Now I want you...
Yes, what is it, Brother Dunnikin?
The little brother lowered his hand.
Don't know any mystic prunes, Grandmaster. Not to what you might call chant.
Hmph! He opened the book. He'd been rather surprised to find, after pages and pages of pious ramblings, that the actual summoning itself was one short sentence. Not a chant, not a brief piece of poetry, but a mere assemblage of meaningless syllables. De Malachite said they caused interference patterns in the waves of reality, but the daft old fool was probably making it up as he went along. That was the trouble with wizards. They had to make everything look difficult. All you really needed was willpower, and the Brethren had a lot of that. Small-minded and vitriolic willpower, yes, lousy with malignity, maybe, but still powerful enough in its way. They'd try nothing fancy this time round, somewhere inconspicuous. Around him the Brethren were chanting what each man considered, according to his lights, to be something mystical. The general effect was actually quite good if you didn't listen to the words. The words. Oh, yes. He looked down and spoke them aloud. Nothing happened. He blinked. When he opened his eyes again, he was in a dark alley. His stomach was full of fire, and he was very angry. It was about to be the worst night of his life for Zebo Mooty, thief, third class, and it wouldn't have made him any happier to know that it was also going to be the last one. The rain was keeping people indoors, and he was way behind on his quota. He was therefore a little less cautious than he might otherwise have been. In the nighttime streets of Ankh-Morpork, caution is an absolute. There was no such thing as moderately cautious. You are either very cautious, or you are dead. You might be walking around and breathing, but you're dead just the same. He heard the muffled sounds coming from the nearby alley, slid his leather-bound cosh from his sleeve, waited until the victim was almost turning the corner, sprang out, said, "Oh, shit!" and died. It was a most unusual death. No one else had died like that for hundreds of years. The stone wall behind him glowed cherry red with heat, which gradually faded into the darkness. He was the first to see the Ankh-Morpork dragon. He derived little comfort from knowing this, however, because he was dead.
"It!"
he said, and his disembodied self looked down at the small heap of charcoal, which he knew with an unfamiliar sort of certainty was what he had just been disembodied from. It was a strange sensation, seeing your own mortal remains. He didn't find it as horrifying as he would have imagined if you'd asked him, say, 10 minutes ago. Finding that you are dead is mitigated also by finding that there really is a you who can find you dead. The alley opposite was empty again.
"That was really strange," said Mooty.
"Extremely unusual, certainly."
"Did you see that? What was it?"
Mooty looked up at the dark figure emerging from the shadows.
"Who are you, anyway?"
he added suspiciously.
"Guess," said the voice.
Mooty peered at the hooded figure.
"Caw," he said, "I thought you didn't turn up for the likes of me."
"I turn up for everyone."
I mean, in person sort of thing?
Sometimes, on special occasions.
Yeah, well, said Mooty, this is one of them all right. I mean, it looked like a bloody dragon. What's a man to do? You don't expect to find a dragon around the corner.
And now, if you would care to step this way, said Death, laying a skeletal hand on Mooty's shoulder.
Do you know, a fortune teller once told me I'd die in my bed surrounded by grieving great-grandchildren, said Mooty, following the stately figure. What do you think of that, eh?
I think she was wrong.
A bloody dragon, said Mooty. Fire-breathing, too. Did I suffer much?
No, it was practically instantaneous.
That's good. I wouldn't like to think I'd suffered much.
Mooty looked around him.
What happens now? He said.
Behind them, the rain washed the little heap of black ash into the mud. The Supreme Grand Master opened his eyes. He was lying on his back. Brother Dunnikin was preparing to give him the kiss of life. The mere thought was enough to jerk anyone from the borders of consciousness. He sat up, trying to shed the feeling that he weighed several tons and was covered in scales.
"We did it," he whispered. "The dragon! It came! I felt it!"
The brethren glanced at one another. "We never saw nothing," said Brother Plasterer. "I might have seen something," said Brother Watchtower loyally.
"No, not here," snapped the Supreme Grand Master. "You hardly want it to materialize here, do you? It was out there, in the city, just for a few seconds," he pointed. "Look!"
The brethren turned around guiltily, expecting at any moment the hot flame of retribution. In the center of the circle, the magic items were gently crumbling to dust. Even as they watched, Brother Dunnikin's amulet collapsed.
"Sucked dry," whispered Brother Fingers. "I'll be damned."
$3 that amulet cost me," muttered Brother Dunnikin.
"But it proves it works," said the Supreme Grand Master. "Don't you see, fools? It works. We can summon dragons."
"Could be a bit expensive in magical items," said Brother Fingers doubtfully.
$3 it was. No rubbish."
"Power," growled the Supreme Grand Master, "does not come cheap."
"Very true," nodded Brother Watchtower. "Not cheap. Very true."
He looked at the little heap of exhausted magic again.
"Caw," he said. "We did it, though, didn't we? We only went and bloody well did some magic, right?"
"See," said Brother Fingers, "I told you there was nothing to it."
"You all did exceptionally well," said the Supreme Grand Master encouragingly. "Should have been $6, but he said he'd cut his own throat and sell at me for $3.
"Yeah," said Brother Watchtower. "We got the hang of it all right. Didn't hurt a bit. We done real magic. And didn't get et by tooth fairies from out the woodwork either, Brother Plasterer, I couldn't help noticing."
The other brethren nodded. Real magic. Nothing to it. Everyone had just better watch out.
"Hang on, though," said Brother Plasterer. "Where's this dragon gone? I mean, did we really summon it or not?"
"Fancy you asking a silly question like that," said Brother Watchtower doubtfully.
The Supreme Grand Master brushed the dust off his mystic robe.
"We summoned it," he said, "and it came. But only as long as the magic lasted. Then it went back. If we want it to stay longer, we need more magic. Understand? And that is what we must get."
$3 I shan't see again in a hurry."
"Shut up."
"Dearest Father," wrote Carrot, "well, here I am in Ankh-Morpork. It is not like at home. I think it must have changed a bit since Mr. Varnashi's great-grandfather was here. I don't think people here know right from wrong. I found Captain Vimes in a common alehouse. I remembered what you said about a good dwarf not going into such places, but since he did not come out, I went in. He was lying with his head on the table. When I spoke to him, he said, 'Pull the other one, kid,
it has got bells on. I believe he was the worse for drink. He told me to find a place to stay and report to Sergeant Colon at the watch house tonight. He said anyone wanting to join the guard needed their head examined. Mr. Varneshi did not mention this. Perhaps it is done for reasons of hygiene? I went for a walk. There are many people here. I found a place. It is called The Shades. Then I saw some men trying to rob a young lady. I set about them. They did not know how to fight properly, and one of them tried to kick me in the vitals. But I was wearing the protective as instructed, and he hurt himself. Then the lady came up to me and said, "Was I interested in bed?" I said yes. She took me to where she lived. A boarding house, I think it is called. It is run by a Mrs. Palm. The lady whose purse it was, she is called Reet, said, "You should have seen him. There were three of them. It was amazing." Mrs. Palm said, "It is on the house." She said, "What a big protective." So I went upstairs and fell asleep, although it is a very noisy place. Reet woke me up once or twice to say, "Do you want anything?" But they had no apples. So I have fallen on my feet, as they say here, but I don't see how that is possible, because if you fall off your feet, it is common sense. There is certainly a lot to do. When I went to see the sergeant, I saw a place called the Thieves' Guild. I asked Mrs. Palm, and she said, "Of course." She said the leaders of the thieves in the city meet there. I went to the watch house and met Sergeant Colon, a very fat man, and when I told him about the Thieves' Guild, he said, "Don't be a idiot. I do not think he is serious." He says, "Don't you worry about thieves' guilds. This is all what you have to do. You walk along the streets at night shouting, 'It's 12 o'clock and all's well.'" I said, "What if it is not all well?" And he said, "You bloody well find another street." This is not leadership. I have been given some chain mail. It is rusty and not well made. They give you money for being a guard. It is $20 a month. When I get it, I will send you it. I hope you are all well and that shaft number 5 is now open. This afternoon I will go and look at the Thieves' Guild. It is disgraceful. If I do something about it, it will be a feather in my cap. I am getting the hang of how they talk here already. Your loving son, Carrot. P.S. Please give all my love to Minty. I really miss her. Lord Vetinari, the patrician of Ankh-Morpork, put his hand over his eyes.
"He did... what?"
"I was marched through the streets," said Erdo Van Pugh, currently president of the Guild of Thieves, Burglars and Allied Trades, "in broad daylight, with my hands tied together." He took a few steps towards the patrician's severe chair of office, waving a finger. "You know very well that we have kept within the budget," he said. "To be humiliated like that, like a common criminal, there had better be a full apology," he said, "or you will have another strike on your hands. We will be driven to it, despite our natural civic responsibilities," he added. It was the finger. The finger was a mistake. The patrician was staring coldly at the finger. Van Pugh followed his gaze and quickly lowered the digit. The patrician was not a man you shook a finger at unless you wanted to end up being able to count only to 9.
"And you say this was one person?" said Lord Vetinari.
"Yes, that is..." Van Pugh hesitated. It did sound weird now he came to tell someone.
"But there are hundreds of you in there," said the patrician calmly. "Thick as, you should excuse the expression, thieves."
Van Pugh opened and shut his mouth a few times. The honest answer would have been yes, and if anyone had come sidling in and skulking around the corridors, it would have been the worse for them. It was the way he strode in as if he owned the place that fooled everyone, that and the fact that he kept hitting people and telling them to mend their ways. The patrician nodded.
"I shall deal with the matter momentarily,"
he said. It was a good word. It always made people hesitate. They were never quite sure whether he'd meant he'd deal with it now, or just deal with it briefly, and no one ever dared ask. Van Pugh backed down. A full apology, mark you. I have a position to maintain, he added.
Thank you. Do not let me detain you, said the patrician once again, giving the language his own individual spin.
Right, good. Thank you. Very well, said the thief.
After all, you have such a lot of work to do,
Lord Vetinari went on. Well, of course, this is the case. The thief hesitated. The patrician's last remark had barbs on it. You found yourself waiting for him to strike. He said, hoping for a clue.
With so much business being conducted, that is.
Panic took over the thief's features. Randomized guilt flooded his mind. It wasn't a case of what had he done. It was a question of what the patrician had found out about. The man had eyes everywhere, none of them so terrifying as the icy blue ones just above his nose. I don't quite follow, he began.
Curious choice of targets.
The patrician picked up a sheet of paper.
For example, a crystal ball belonging to a fortune teller in Shear Street. A small ornament from the temple of Offla the crocodile god, and so on. Gewgaws.
I'm afraid I really don't know, said the head thief. The patrician leaned forward.
No unlicensed thieving, surely, he said.
One of the remarkable innovations introduced by the patrician was to make the Thieves' Guild responsible for theft, with annual budgets, forward planning, and above all, rigid job protection. Thus, in return for an agreed average level of crime per annum, the thieves themselves saw to it that unauthorized crime was met with the full force of injustice, which was generally a stick with nails in it.
I shall look into it directly, stuttered the head thief. Depend upon it.
The patrician gave him a sweet smile.
I'm sure I can, he said. Thank you for coming to see me. Don't hesitate to leave.
The thief shuffled out. It was always like this with the patrician, he reflected bitterly. You came to him with a perfectly reasonable complaint. Next thing you knew, you were shuffling out backwards, bowing and scraping, relieved simply to be getting away. You had to hand it to the patrician, he admitted grudgingly. If you didn't, he sent men to come and take it away. When he'd gone, Lord Vetinari rang the little bronze bell that summoned his secretary. The man's name, despite his handwriting, was Lupine Wants. He appeared, pen poised. You could say this about Lupine Wants. He was neat. He always gave the impression of just being completed. Even his hair was so smoothed down and oiled it looked as though it had been painted on.
The watch appears to be having some difficulty with the Thieves' Guild, said the patrician. Van Pugh has been in here claiming that a member of the watch arrested him.
What for, sir?
Being a thief, apparently.
A member of the watch? Said the secretary.
I know, but just sort it out, will you?
The patrician smiled to himself. It was always hard to fathom Lord Vetinari's idiosyncratic sense of humour, but a vision of the red-faced, irate head thief kept coming back to him. One of the patrician's greatest contributions to the reliable operation of Ankh-Morpork had been very early in his administration the legalizing of the ancient Guild of Thieves. Crime was always with us, he reasoned, and therefore, if you were going to have crime, at least it should be organized crime. And so the Guild had been encouraged to come out of the shadows and build a big guild house, take their place at civic banquets, and set up their training college with day-release courses and city and guild certificates and everything. In exchange for the winding down of the watch, they agreed, while trying to keep their faces straight, to keep crime levels to a level to be determined annually. That way, everyone could plan ahead, said Lord Vetinari, and part of the uncertainty had been removed from the chaos that is life. And then, a little while later, the patrician summoned the leading thieves again and said, Oh, by the way, there was something else. What was it now? Oh, yes.
"I know who you are," he said. "I know where you live. I know what kind of horse you ride. I know where your wife has her hair done. I know where your lovely children... How old are they now? My, doesn't time fly. I know where they play. So you won't forget about what we agreed, will you?" And he smiled. So did they, after a fashion. And in fact, it had turned out very satisfactorily from everyone's point of view. It took the head thieves very little time to grow paunches and start having coats of arms made and meet in a proper building rather than smoky dens, which no one had liked much. A complicated arrangement of receipts and vouchers saw to it that while everyone was eligible for the attentions of the guild, no one had too much, and this was very acceptable, at least to those citizens who were rich enough to afford the quite reasonable premiums the guild charged for an uninterrupted life. There was a strange foreign word for this, in sewer ants. No one knew exactly what it had originally meant, but Ankh Morpork had made it its own. The Watch hadn't liked it, but the plain fact was that the thieves were far better at controlling crime than the Watch had ever been. After all, the Watch had to work twice as hard to cut crime just a little, whereas all the guild had to do was work less. And so the city prospered, while the Watch had dwindled away like a useless appendix into a handful of unemployables who no one in their right mind could ever take seriously. The last thing anyone wanted them to do was get it into their heads to fight crime. But seeing the head thief discommoded was always worth the trouble, the patrician felt. Captain Vimes knocked very hesitantly at the door, because each tap echoed around his skull. "Enter." Vimes removed his helmet, tucked it under his arm, and pushed the door open. Its creak was a blunt saw across the front of his brain. He always felt uneasy in the presence of Lupine once. Come to that, he felt uneasy in the presence of Lord Vetinari, but that was different. That was down to breeding. And ordinary fear, of course. Whereas he'd known once since their childhood in the Shades. The boy had shown promise even then. He was never a gang leader. Never a gang leader. Hadn't got the strength or stamina for that. And after all, what was the point in being a gang leader? Behind every gang leader, there were a couple of lieutenants bucking for promotion. Being a gang leader is not a job with long-term prospects. But in every gang, there is a pale youth who's allowed to stay because he's the one who comes up with all the clever ideas, usually to do with old women and unlock shops. This was once's natural place in the order of things. Vimes had been one of the middle rankers, the falsetto equivalent of a yes-man. He remembered once, as a skinny little kid, always tagging along behind in hand-me-down pants with the kind of odd skipping run he'd invented to keep up with the bigger boys, and forever coming up with fresh ideas to stop them idly ganging up on him, which was the usual recreation if nothing more interesting presented itself. It was superb training for the rigours of adulthood, and once became good at it. Yes, they'd both started in the gutter, but once had worked his way up, whereas he himself would be the first to admit Vimes had merely worked his way along. Every time he seemed to be getting anywhere, he spoke his mind or said the wrong thing, usually both at once. That was what made him uncomfortable around once. It was the ticking of the bright clockwork of ambition. Vimes had never mastered ambition. It was something that happened to other people.